This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Okay, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to the second episode of For Your Consideration. Place to Be Nation is doing a poll of the greatest WWE wrestler, and I thought it would be a fun idea to examine some of the wrestlers from the different eras. And we're going to talk about a lot of the main eventers and most popular wrestlers, but we're also going to dig into some of the lesser wrestlers, some of the overlooked wrestlers. And joining me today, I have from Exile and Bad Street and Between the Sheets, my good buddy, Chris Zellner. We used to do the reaction shows together. Chris, what's going on, buddy?
It's going good, Ben. A long time since we've done a show together.
I know, man. Probably one of the pay-per-views last year. I don't know.
Yeah, it's been many months, for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. And joining me again is my buddy, Steve Williams, whose claim to fame is, as he told me on the last show, he was the runner-up in the Place to Be Nation trivia contest, right? Steve, I still thought you won it, man. Didn't you? But were you the only person to do like 10 answers, though, in a row? In a round?
I do have that much to take credit for. It's good to be here. Thanks a lot for having me on again.
Yeah, well, you're our champion, all right, man? So we're going to call you the unofficial trivia champion.
And another Steve, Steve Williams in wrestling.
Oh God, that'd be the third one, right? Well, wow, I never even put that together.
I'm the Gino Hernandez of trivia contest.
That's crazy, man. I've known you for like a year and a half, Steve, and I never even put together that you were the third one, because I thought about the Dr. Death, Steve Williams, because on my phone, you're as a contact, I have you under Dr. Death, Steve Williams, right?
Fantastic.
But I completely forgot that Steve Austin was also Steve Williams. So there we go. So anyway, on the first episode, we covered wrestlers from the mid-2000s. Well, now we're going to cover wrestlers from the early to mid-90s. For lack of a better term, we're going to just call it the new generation era, right? Or the warrior era leading to the new generation era. That sounds about right, right? Yeah. Anyone object to that?
No, it's fine.
That sounds good, right?
Yeah.
And so the first wrestler we're going to discuss tonight, and Steve selected this guy, and I'm really interested because I know of a few decent matches, and he had a feud with the 1-2-3 Kid, but I don't know if he's strong enough to be on a greatest WWE wrestler list, and that's Hakushi, all right, also known as Jinsei Shinzaki from FMW in Japan. But Steve, why don't you talk about some of the highlights and major angles and moments of Hakushi's WWF career?
And when I think Hakushi right away, I think the Bret Hart feud in 1995. I was there fifth row for the July 1995 Raw match where he busted out the Space Flying Tiger Drop, I think it's called, in America for the first time. Also had a great match with the 1-2-3 Kid. I think it was at SummerSlam that year. After that, unfortunately, there's not a whole lot going on. He was on the losing team with Barry Horowitz at Survivor Series that year, and then just kind of faded away after that. He was, along with Kid and Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, probably the work rate guys at a time when work rate was null and void in WWF. You had Man Mountain Rock and Shitty Undertaker and Kama and those types running around, Mantar. So he was kind of a bright spot in a dark period, which is why I thought he deserved a little bit of a better look.
Okay. And now I know he brought up Barry Horowitz. He's one of the few people to lose to Barry Horowitz.
I completely forgot that happened until just the second.
Yeah, and I think the problem I have with Hakushi here is that he's kind of just, and WWE is really guilty of doing this, evil Japanese stereotype, right?
Well, absolutely.
He had the face paint. Like, there's no depth to his character. It wasn't Fuji. He was his manager. It was like some weird guy in a
Shinma, like, Kiyosato.
There you go. Okay. Who's Mr. Shinma,
Kiyosato, yeah.
From the Orient Express team.
Yeah, from Tarzan Goto and Kiyosato from Memphis.
Oh, yeah. Really? From like the one that was like fighting the Steiners and Cactus Jack when that era of Memphis,
no,
right?
The ones fighting Jeff Jarrett and Billy Joe Travis and Pat Tanaka. That era of Memphis.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm thinking of Hashimoto. Who was Hashimoto's
Shinji Sasazaki. Shogun okay. Samurai.
And they were Shogun Samurai. Yeah, that's correct. Okay.
Akio Sato worked in the U.S. for many years in different territories. He was the liaison between All Japan and the territories, pretty much, in a lot of ways.
Oh, okay. Well, see, I never knew that. See, that's why we have you on the show, Chris, to give us that wrestling history right there.
Yeah, and they had him in the white face paint with the all-white suit as the manager.
Yeah, and were there any points, Steve, you were watching Hakushi, where you just thought this guy's in the wrong position, he should be higher up on the card, you know, he should be wrestling someone else besides Bret Hart, Barry Horowitz, or 1-2-3 Kid, all good wrestlers, by the way.
Now, had he stuck around for another year, it would have been interesting to see how he would have acclimated himself with Steve Austin getting into the mix and Mankind arriving a little bit later. I mean, the way Mankind was positioned, he would have ran right through Hakushi at the time.
Right.
But I think he was about a year too soon.
Yeah, and I think he lost to Quang on his way out, too. So, yeah, that Quang feud.
Because he turned babyface.
Right. So, not Quang, you mean Hakushi.
Yeah, Hakushi, yes. Yeah. Yeah, when he was with Horowitz.
No, okay. Quang turned Puerto Rican.
Yes, and turned babyface, too. That's a great way. And when you talk Hakushi, you can't forget the moment of him holding the severed head of Bret Hart.
What? When was that?
Dude, I was there. I was 13 years old, man, and he had that damn bag in a burlap sack that he was carrying around.
But they didn't actually show it like the PWI cover of Hogan's head on.
No, he held the head in his hand. I mean, he was holding it by the hair.
It was very obviously a mannequin head of some sort.
Yeah. But it was just symbolism.
Man, I kind of wanted it to be Bret Hart's head, man.
I don't think it regenerated itself after the fact.
I did. You know what, man? That's how much research I did for Hakushi, okay? Because I had no idea that ever happened. But let me ask you, Steve, would he have a shot of making your top 100? Like, is he in the running?
It's highly unlikely.
Okay. All right, good. I was glad to hear you say that. Chris, do you want to add anything on Hakushi before we move on to the next?
I mean, he's famous in Brett's book for Brett talking about how that feud was the feud where he knew he was being pretty much relegated to just about mid-card status at that time period in WWF. So, it had some good matches, but Brett wasn't too happy with his standing in the company at times. So, but Hakushi, I mean, that's pretty much his most famous thing is that and the Horowitz thing. So he had a fun little run, but that was it.
Yeah. He had great matches in FMW.
Oh, Michinoku like, Pro. Legitimate. I mean, god damn. Yeah. In FMW, Hayabusa's staff partner in All Japan. So, oh, yes, his run in Japan is pretty strong. But WF, not so much.
Right. Yeah, and I'm guessing if you were to make a list, Chris, he would have no shot at your top.
Top 100 WF? No.
Yeah, me neither. So let's move on to another guy who probably has no shot at making any of our lists. But I wanted to talk about him because right before the Attitude Era, kind of in that no man's land era, this guy was probably one of the most over wrestlers of that time period. And this is a guy I picked, and I just wanted to kind of explore his run, and that's Ahmed Johnson, okay? And you can say what you want about his wrestling ability, how sloppy he was, but, man, he was energetic. He was charismatic as all can be, and he was over. I mean, the crowd loved Ahmed. I mean, here was a guy who was, like, roided to the gills, flying over the top rope to the outside, you know, just with reckless abandon. And he was, you know, I almost feel like they almost should have positioned him like Goldberg. Nothing more than 5 minutes, just squashing dudes super quick, get him in, get him out of the ring. I mean, he could have been the precursor to Goldberg. I really enjoy his Goldust match. Was that at SummerSlam?
King of the Ring.
Or was it just in King of the Ring? Okay, good. That's why I have you here, Chris. And I enjoy portions. I enjoyed the beginning and the end. The middle, not so much, you know. But anyway, I still thought it was kind of a cool feud, you know, with the Goldust giving him mouth-to-mouth and Ahmed freaking out. To me, the worst thing about that feud were the announcers, you know, carrying on like Goldust had, you know, killed his children or something. But anyway, the worst part of his run, I would argue, is the Farouk feud. You know, that's kind of when he really lost steam, because I think he got injured right around the time that feud was kicking off. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes. Well, he got injured a lot. Yeah. I mean, that was the running thing. He would get injured, come back, get injured, come back, get injured, come back, and then gone.
Yes, Farouk debuted by injuring Ahmed Johnson. The first run-in, he kicked Ahmed in the kidney, and he was out for 6 months after
that.
Man, okay, so my point stands. And anyway, even though he was over, And like I said, I think the WWE really did mess up by not protecting him more or by forcing him to have longer matches than he should have had. Because the Pearl River Plunge was over, man. Once he dropped people with that Pearl River, man, people were hyped for it. But when he actually did promos, this was another weakness. You couldn't understand a damn thing he was saying, man. It's almost like, have you ever heard a Butch Reed do a shoot interview, Chris?
Yes.
You know how he kind of mumbles?
Yeah, but Butch Reed was a great promo, though, in wrestling. But yeah, I know where you're going.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But that's what I'm saying. You take Butch Reed sitting down doing a shoot interview, and that's how Ahmed Johnson's promo turned up to 9, you know? But anyway, he's a guy, actually, that he's a kind of a guilty pleasure for me. Because, you know, when we think of, like, guys who just appeal to you, like, wow, like, ultimately not a good wrestler. But, you know, I might have him at, like, 99 or something. Like, maybe just, like, one spot above Ultimate Warrior or something, you know? Steve, any thoughts on Ahmed?
I think his highlight was probably body-slamming Yokozuna at the Survivor Series in 95. It was interesting, right before he got hurt, he was positioned as the number one contender, presumably to get a shot against Shawn Michaels. He gets hurt, and that disappears. Wonder if they were ever going to pull the trigger on that match or not. That would have been interesting in summer of 96 to see how they booked their way out of that. That being said, he was incredibly energetic, really over for a very short period, and then just one of the most terrific nosedives of a career I've ever seen. He joined the Nation of Domination after being their bitch for about 4 months, and then immediately turned back. They once entered the Royal Rumble with hoop earrings in.
Yes.
Try to get the crowd to chant, "You're going down," as a thing.
Hold on. It was the 90s. Even I had hoop earrings, man. I'm just saying.
But you weren't wrestling with hoop earrings, man. Like, it was just the exemplary of just not giving a single shit. And yeah, he's not making my list at all.
Oh, come on, man. Position 99, dude. Come on.
He's just missing the cut at 102.
Oh, okay. That's fair. Is there anything to say about Ahmed before?
I was a huge Ahmed Johnson fan when he first started.
Amen, Chris. Amen.
I mean, they did a tremendous job of getting him over, Vince especially on commentary, and he eventually showed up in Memphis as well, and he had a unified title match with Lawler that they played up big on Memphis television. Around in late 95, early 96, where Ahmed Johnson on the telephone, when they did the live show, was talking about how he was scouting Jerry Lawler by watching his match against Terry Gordy from the Sportatorium in 1989. I love that. But I thought he was going to be the next big thing. Then he started to gain weight and Danny got hurt, and it just was a train wreck after that. Recently, on Between the Sheets, we covered when he quit in 97. You know, he had gone downhill, then got into a backstage deal and quit and just didn't show up. And then he shows up, you know, 2 years later in WCW as Big T, and he got fat.
Oh,
and now, if you look at him now, he looks like Abdullah the Butcher's son. He's gained so much weight.
Really?
Yeah, he just does not look the same. But yeah, he was different for WF because WF never had a black guy like him. You know?
Absolutely not. No. They were all dancers and shucking and jiving, you know, whether it was Coco, Tony Atlas, SD Jones, right? I mean,
yeah.
They all kind of played the same. Rocky Johnson, they all played the same.
I mean, yeah, and Men on a Mission was there at the time, which they had already turned them heel. So, you know, Mabel was already a heel in that era. But, yeah, Ahmed, he just was a different dude. And you could see him. This guy was a tremendous athlete. Raw around the edges. But, God, and especially Washington Global. I mean, dude was doing dives to the floor as Modiv.
Yes.
I mean, the guy had plenty of talent. And some people say that the fast push got to his head, too. But, I mean, I was a fan of him, but I don't know. He, if I put him on the list, he would be like my 99 for 100th guy too. Will he'd be there as like a personal pick that we used to do the old DVDR projects, you know, he would be like a personal pick, but, yeah, I was a fan of my man. So I got no problem with somebody maybe putting him on the list.
Okay, fair enough. Well, Chris, we're going to talk about another guy that you and I are both a fan of, and that's Earthquake, okay, or John Tenta. And, you know, we're calling him Earthquake for this show. I mean, we can go into Earthquake Golga, right?
He was Earthquake, basically. I mean, that was his big run.
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, Chris, like, I'd always thought, man, you know, if John Tenta's on the TV, I'm turning the station. Like, I just have no use for him. Whether it was when he was having his run or later in life when I was watching DVDs and tapes. You know, and then when we did the All Japan project, we saw like a really great John Tenta tag match. And it was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, that's how late in the game I was to John Tenta. And then all of a sudden, every time I saw him wrestle, it was like, wait, this guy's really good. This guy's having really good matches. And all of a sudden, I just became a fan. And so why don't you tell everyone why you chose Earthquake, run down some of the highlights and what you would consider some low points in his WWF career.
Well, he first came in as a guy, basically, I wouldn't say from the crowd, but he was just a guy that came in to help Dino Bravo. And he became the Earthquake. And it wasn't too long, and you know, until 1990, they did the big angle where he crushed Hulk Hogan's ribs on the Brother Love show, put Hulk Hogan out of action, so he could go film. I think it was Suburban Commando at the time, so he could take the break, and that got Earthquake over huge, and it was all to build to SummerSlam, and where Hogan and Earthquake had their big match, and Hogan got his win, but still they kept Earthquake strong throughout, and Earthquake spent the rest of 1990, you know, doing matches with Hogan, but you know, still lingering around that top area. Then 1991, they changed his gear, which that was my favorite Earthquake gear, was when he went to a dark blue with the little seismic thing on his front of his chest in black.
Right.
And that was one of the LJN, not LJN, the Hasbro figures I bought. The F Hasbro figures I bought was of Earthquake because I love that figure, and
so Hasbro were the little ones, right?
Not yeah, the little ones. Yeah. So, yeah, okay. I bought that one when it first came out, and because I just loved the figure, I just loved this look. I loved the beard, the greasy hair. I loved that tattoo, and then he had the big angle with Jake where he killed Damien. On during sweeps on I think it was Superstars.
Oh, one of the best angles of that time.
Well, that was yeah, and that was when WWF was going more with harder edge stories in 91, and that was one of the first ones they did of that. You know, of course, later.
Well, hold on. When did I think it was it 91 or 92 when Savage got bitten?
It was later 91. Yeah, that's when Jake brought his other snake in, when he brought Lucifer in after exactly. Damien ate his defeat by Earthquake. But Earthquake was, you know, after that he had his little thing with Jake and he was just on the scene. But they turned Typhoon, they turned Tugboat into Typhoon, formed Natural Disasters, right, and became one of the top tag teams for a year plus, winning the tag titles.
But, hold on.
Yeah.
Hold on, though. What did you think about Natural Disasters? Because I think, and I don't necessarily want to blame Typhoon, but I'm going to kind of, because I don't even think that was Fred Ottman,
correct,
right?
Yeah, was
Typhoon?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even think he was nominated. Like, Earthquake nominated Typhoon, not even nominated for this project, you know? But I can't even think of a, like, great Natural Disasters match. Is there one? And if you can't think of one, we'll ask Steve.
No. But they had this look. They had the look of these two large men, and they were a dominant force. Were they in good matches? No, definitely not. But
I guess the reason I bring that up is because, like, Twin Towers were like this dominant, huge monster tag team, and they did have a good match.
Yeah, but and they weren't together as long as Natural Disasters were, or got the titles, you know. And that's the WF tag teams are a little different, because WF tag team scene wasn't treated as seriously as WCW or NWA treated their tag team scene, so. It worked for WWF at the time. Money Inc. wasn't no great shakes either as a tag team. Then, of course, that was the feud when Jimmy Hart turned on the Natural Disasters and they turned babyface. So you got Babyface Earthquake, which I wasn't a fan of Babyface Earthquake because that just wasn't a babyface character, seeing Happy Smiley John Tenta around. But
right,
it kind of eventually worked, though, when in 94. They did the mini feud with Yokozuna, where him and Yokozuna had a sumo match.
It was awesome. I just watched it the other day.
So that worked because Tenta had this sumo background. He's a legitimate sumo. And then you put him up against, you know, Yokozuna, who's not a legitimate sumo, but pushed that way. And yeah, I dug that whole deal there between those two guys. And then it wasn't too long after that, though, he was gone with WCW. And of course, went back, you know, years later as Golga, as one of the Oddities, which was funny because
absolutely the low point of his
career. Yeah, right? Which is funny because when we did Between the Sheets, on a Between the Sheets show on 1997, in fact, the same show we talked about Ahmed Johnson quitting, it was talking about him coming in, and they had planned on making him a top contender for the world title when he first came in. Because he had dropped all that weight. You know, they were really impressed with him. And they were going to make him one of the top heels in the company. And then he ended up being one of the Oddities. Vince Russo, everybody. But, but during his prime run, definitely he was one of the top characters in the company. And I see no reason why he shouldn't be in the lower part of the top 100 for sure. Easily.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he was a great big man, and as a heel, I think he always had a manager with him, right? Wasn't it Jimmy?
Well, it was with Jimmy and Dino Bravo, and then when Bravo left, it was Jimmy, and then he turned babyface, and yeah, happy smiling Earthquake was not the best thing, but you know, whatever.
Yeah, but you're right, that Yokozuna feud was awesome.
Yeah,
you know. But okay, well, let's go to you, Steve. What were your impressions of John Tenta's Earthquake?
Earthquake is responsible for two of my earliest wrestling memories. The first, before I was even watching, was when he squashed Hulk Hogan. And I'm the youngest of a set of about eight cousins. They were all just losing their shit talking about it the next day. So right away, I wanted to see this guy responsible for putting Hogan on the shelf. The other was the Tugboat / Typhoon turn was the first babyface to heel turn I think I ever saw, as it happened on Challenger Superstars, whatever the hell the show it was. That being said, the Natural Disasters team, it's not entirely their fault. It was not a great team. The tag team scene in that company had kind of fallen apart right about the time they came together. Heart yeah. Foundation and Rockers both break up about that same time. So, you know, who are they going to trust after that?
Well, we're gonna blame the feud with Money Inc. all on Mike Rotundo. It's all his fault for this.
And then they repeated the same angle with the Nasty Boys not too long after it too, where they turn bait face for the same reason.
We're gonna blame that on Mike Rotundo too.
Yeah, the tag teams at the time in the WWF was Nasty Boys, Bushwhackers, LOD, Natural Disasters, Money Inc., and the Beverly Brothers. Not that inspiring.
The Smoking Guns and the Head Shrinkers showed up right after.
Yeah, right after that, yeah. And Power and Glory had just split up and they were gone, so. Yeah, the tag team scene was not. I can admit, New Foundation, Owen and Neidhart. And then High Energy, not after that, Owen and Coco.
But, right. Man, you watch SummerSlam 1990 is a legitimately good Hulk Hogan match.
Absolutely.
Well, and then, Hogan has a lot of legitimately great matches. So.
Yeah, but not that era. Hulk Hogan didn't.
No.
That's true. To be fair, that's true. But
then I can't remember if it's Boss Man or Hogan has the facing the wrong way or hitting Quake with it. He's got these massive welts on his back. He's just a big, tough bastard. Barely flinched or beating the hell out of him with his chair. And just watching him do is something as mundane as hitting the ropes. He's a 400-pound guy hitting those ropes with everything he had. I mean, he certainly was athletic for a big fat guy, for sure. I think he's worthy of a spot on the list.
Yeah, I agree. I have him in my bottom 30, but he's definitely making the list. Like, he's not going to be like Ahmed or Warrior, where he like kind of creeps in at 99 or 100. Like, probably in the top 75 or something like that, somewhere around there. But anyway, well, I'm glad we all agree on Earthquake. Man. It's like one big happy family here on this show. I like it. Right. One big happy inbred Southern family. Now, okay, next guy. And Steve, you picked this guy, and that is Sean Waltman. All right, and we all know about the famous kind of kickstart to his career, doing the deal with Razor Ramon, the big upset. Had some great match with Bret Hart, the King of the Ring match with Owen Hart, the Action Zone tag with his click buddies. Who was it? Was it him and Razor, or him and it was him and Razor versus Sean and Diesel, right? That was a huge match. And let's talk about 1-2-3 Kid first, because eventually we're going to have to talk about X-Pac. But like, why don't you give some highlights of the 1-2-3 Kid run?
You know, you obviously mentioned the May 1993 match that kicked him off. Then they had a rematch a few months later where Razor put $10,000 on the line if Kid could last 10 minutes with him. And that's kind of a fun, underrated match, or forgotten match. A little bit later on, he wrestled IRS at SummerSlam, and that was kind of blah because, again, Mike Rotundo. But he had that fun match with Marty Jannetty where they won the tag titles from the Quebecers. There was a match with Road Dogg, of all people. I think it was the July 1995 In Your House that was shockingly good as well. Probably the best match of Brian Armstrong's career.
No, that is absolutely not true. Armstrong was a great wrestler in the USWA.
All right. Oh, Jesse James Armstrong was fantastic in Memphis. I will give you that, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely a great Memphis wrestler. And they also had a match, I want to say 2000, 2001. It only lasted 6-7 minutes. Really fun pay-per-view match when he was Xbox, when he was with Road Dogg.
Oh, yeah. They a friendly rivalry gimmick leading into SummerSlam 2000, I think it was.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. I don't know.
And then didn't he wrestle Hakushi at SummerSlam?
He had a match with 95? Hakushi, yeah. SummerSlam, I can't remember if it was exactly SummerSlam, but yes, they did work.
I don't remember if it was good or not, you know. I don't remember.
Then he turned heel in 95, which was kind of a mistake with somebody that size. Formed a team with Sid that was fun while it lasted. Unfortunately, it only lasted until softball season. And then kept getting injuries, and before you know it, he pops up in the NWO. And that's kind of an unceremonious end to his first run.
Right. Chris, before we go to his, because, and I, we have to kind of separate the X-Pac run from the 1-2-3 Kid run, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, different eras, so, yeah.
You know, before we get to the X-Pac run, what about his 1-2-3 Kid run stands out that Steve hasn't already mentioned?
Oh, man.
Or do you just want to add something else?
I mean, the tattoo of Bob Holly was good. You know, while it lasted.
Wait, did they
have the tag belts? Yes, at Royal Rumble 95, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, or the Raw after.
Yeah, it's the Lawrence Taylor Angle yes, match was where they
exactly. Won the title. He was a great tag wrestler in WWF, whether it was with Jannetty, Holly, Hall, Razor, just anybody. He was a great tag wrestler. He had injury issues as well, which always hampered him. So that was one thing that would hurt him at times. When he turned heel and joined the Million Dollar Corporation, it just fell flat. They did the whole baby bottle stuff with him and Razor, or baby diaper match, whatever it was. And that was not good. He was having his issues already.
Quick note, I was there for the baby diaper
match. Oh, really? Match.
And the bottle gets thrown into the crowd once Kid wakes up and realizes he's powdered in diaper. He throws the bottle into the crowd. The guy in the row in front of me catches it and unscrews the gimmick nipple off this thing, and it is full of some kind of fluid. I don't know what the hell they had in that bottle. Knowing Kid and Razor at the time, I'm sure it was friendly.
What was it, baby butter? What'd y'all call it? Body butter?
Boy butter. Nah.
Boy butter on a
I don't think there was any boy butter in there. I gotta hope not. But, yeah, it's... That run, I mean, it's more... The most famous part of his run is definitely the work with Razor. No doubt. So, that's the most famous thing. And yeah, I think his other run was probably the best run.
Okay, well, you know, so he returns in 98 as X-Pac. And, you know, they just lost Shawn Michaels, you know, to his first retirement or whatever, second retirement, whatever retirement was. And, you know, I know Hunter was the leader of DX, but I'm sorry. For me, X-Pac returning really, it was kind of like the first time that someone jumped from WCW where it kind of made an impact. I know Jarrett had left. You know, WCW came over to WWF. But, you know, on the other side, Bret Hart had jumped over to WCW. This is kind of like the guy that he came over from the other side and was like, wow, X-Pac or you know, 1-2-3 Kid is here, you know. And I thought that was a really great debut in the company when he debuted, you know, and then did the shoot interview. I don't know if he did the shoot interview that night or the next week. But he does the shoot interview shooting on WCW. And I want to ask you this, Chris. And you know, I mean, I don't think it's a thing, but I know people have. Like, do you even believe there is, like, X-Pac heat, like, go-away heat?
I think it's maybe been overblown, but there is something to it. But that came later. That came in, like, in like 2000, 2001 era. Where when they made him
the leader of X-Pac.
Yeah, yeah, when him and Kane were together and that whole deal with Tori and then X Factor where him and Justin Credible. Yeah. There was a thing where people just didn't want to see the guy. That I mean, I didn't want to see him, and I'm a Sean Waltman fan, but I was like, I'm not enjoying this at all. It's not good. So, yeah, right. There is something to it, yes.
Yeah, and it kind of hurts my ranking of him because, you know, he had, like, a lot of good stuff in that first run. And then, from the X-Pac run, I really liked the Jeff Jarrett hair match at SummerSlam 98. It was entertaining. I don't know if it holds up. I haven't seen it in a long time. But I remember enjoying it when it happened. And I know, like, he was in a four-way with was it? Was it Jericho, Benoit, and Eddie, or Eddie?
The stuff in the early 2000s when the WCW guys came over, that kind of like revitalized him some when he was working against them, for sure.
Right. Until he formed X Factor. But yeah, exactly. So, you know, I mean, so he had some highlights there too. But I think, you know, besides the return, I don't know. I guess he had a good match with Shane McMahon, right?
Yeah.
I guess for an entertaining match at Mania. You know, I don't know, man. As a character, I kind of really hated his promos. I hated his angles, you know, like with the Kane angle that you mentioned before. I didn't really like his promos as, you know, X-Pac. 1-2-3 Kid, you know, he played a really good underdog babyface because he was such a, you know, fresh meat, for lack of a better term. You know, he just looked like
he was at his best in WCW, you know? 6-Pac, though, on promos.
Yes,
that was the more natural character for him because he was more like Lightning Kid Global, you know, in that run as the cocky, you know, heel prick, young, I mean, not young, but the small guy with the big guys as his backup, you know?
Right. So, okay. So, Steve, do you want to add anything to X-Pac before we talk about where we're going to add him on our list?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it X-Pac heat so much as it became X-Pac indifference. And a lot of that is his fault for just not evolving as a character at all. When I think in 1999, I think of Limp Bizkit and I think of X-Pac. And they were both just completely out of sorts 2 years later because neither of those acts changed at all. To me, the highlight X-Pac match was against The Rock at the end of 1998. Come on,
man. Limp Bizkit did like a Who cover behind Blue Eyes, man. That's evolving. Come on. Probably one of the worst cover songs of all time, by the way.
Exactly. It's not great. But he had the title match against The Rock at the end of 1998 on Raw. That was one of my favorite Jim Ross calls. He did some good character work in 99 with Kane, but then once they reformed DX at the end of 99 and he went heel, just nothing after that really speaks to me at all.
I think the historical significance really helps his case out because of how big that was for him to make the jump.
Yeah,
that makes people look at him more fondly than if it was some other guy, just because he did that and how big that was.
Yeah, put this way, him and Boss Man were both in the NWO early on, right?
Was Boss Man in the NWO? I can't even remember.
When they did the gimmick where Bischoff told everybody they had 30 days to pick a side, he was one of the first guys with Bagwell.
That's right.
Yeah. And so Boss Man also came over shortly after, maybe a year after, whatever. But like even Boss Man's like jump didn't make any impact. You know, I was kind of like compare those two. Whereas X-Pac going over was like a holy shit moment. You know?
Well, they treated it that way because he replaced Shawn Michaels in DX the night after WrestleMania, and DX basically was turned babyface in that same moment.
Right. So, you know, so putting those two runs together, 1-2-3 Kid and X-Pac, where would he be on your list, Chris?
He's got a shot to make the bottom part of the list. I wouldn't say he's a definite. He's definitely on the short list before the final list. He's got a shot.
And what about you, Steve?
He may land as high as the 60 to 80 range on my list.
Okay. See, I'm kind of having a dilemma here because I think of the stuff with Razor. I think of his great matches with Brett, and then I'll have him up in as high as 50, in the top 50. And then I think of stuff like X Factor and the Kane feud, and then he always drops a few spots. But then, like, I'll think of the OR match, and I'll raise him up. Like, he's going to be in the middle of my list somewhere. I just I don't know how high or low. I guess it depends on how I feel the day I turn in my ballot, but I don't know where he's going to. I don't know if he's going to stay in the top 50 or drop out of it. I guess it just depends on what match I watched the day before, you know. So he's kind of one of the hardest guys for me to rate. Him and Undertaker, I'm really having this like moral dilemma on where to put these two guys. So we'll get to Undertaker on a later show. We're not going to cover his run here, although we could, but we're not going to. Instead, we're going to now cover the greatest wrestler of all time, Jerry Lawler, and specifically his WWF run. And I would say Jerry Lawler is the greatest wrestler of all time, but he's not the greatest WWF wrestler of all time. Having said that, the man has had some amazing feuds. Whether it was the Miz feud, later on in 2000, what was it, 2011, 2010, 12?
Somewhere in that area, yeah.
Something, right?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah, the end of 2010, I think.
Right, where they had the great ladder match, and then they had the great pay-per-view match around that time period. I think of No Way Out, where you actually thought Jerry Lawler could pull the upset and win the title. Unfortunately, that led to a horrible Miz John Cena match at WrestleMania, but that's for another time. Bret Hart feud. What I loved about the Bret Hart feud, well, there are a couple of things I love about this feud. One, the matches were good. Okay. I mean, some of the matches were stupid, like this My Foot match, really stupid, but the matches themselves were really good. I don't care that Bret Hart doesn't have respect for Jerry Lawler. Bret Hart's an asshole. Whatever. But this was a feud that transcended two companies. It made Vince McMahon a heel in Memphis. Do y'all remember that? When Vince cut his heel promos in Memphis? It made Jerry Lawler was the face in Memphis, the face of Memphis. And then he'd be the heel in New York and then explain it away on Memphis TV that, you know, he's not going to show those New Yorkers any respect. And the people in Memphis, oh, okay, Jerry, we're behind you. But... So I love that he was able to do that. I actually thought his match with Piper was good, bad finish, but I thought the match itself was really good. And in the ring, man, I mean, whenever he didn't wrestle often on TV, but when he did, he really have good, solid matches when given, you know, 5 to 10 minutes. I mean, just because Jerry Lawler is just one of the most sound wrestlers ever, over and over. And Steve, you and I were talking about this earlier. And that would be the feud he had with Tommy Dreamer that kind of, you know, is more like Jerry Lawler versus ECW, but it covered three promotions. It covered USWA, and I know you were around. Did you get to see that there in Louisville?
Yeah, it was the last Tuesday night Louisville Garden show I attended was Lawler and Tommy Dreamer in the main event.
See, now I'm envious of you. Okay, so from now on, we're not going to talk about your trivia contest win. We're going to talk about you attending Lawler versus Dreamer in the last Louisville Garden show. Okay,
I'll take that gimmick upgrade.
That's a gimmick upgrade. Yeah, and then they would have Lawler talking trash about ECW when the ECW guys popped up on Raw, and then they had like some really hot ECW matches, Lawler and Dreamer. So I love that Lawler was kind of the linchpin to that. And then, you know, he had other great matches with the Taz feud was really, really good when him and Taz feuded. I mean, the matches weren't long. They weren't like murky matches, but they were good matches. And he also had a really good match with Stevie Richards. I want to say it was at Royal Rumble. And I watched that with my good buddy, Phil Schneider. And we were just shocked. We were like, man, we don't think anybody had ever, praised that match, and both of us were kind of in awe of how good it was. And so, you know, he has a lot of highlights. So I don't have him in my top 10, but I do think I have Lawler in my top 20 because he's one of those few characters where he really went all in on the character. And I'm not counting the announcer or commentator bit against him because it's not part of the criteria Place to Be wants to use for this contest. So all that annoying puppies and, you know, dirty old man shtick. I'm not counting that against them because it's not part of the criteria. So having said all this, making my case here for why Lawler is a great WWF wrestler, Chris, impressions of his run here.
I mean, yeah, he was in a lot of memorable stuff, no doubt. The Brett feud went for shit, basically 4 years until Brett turned heel, and then they had like a simpatico on television where basically they were like, all is forgiven, you know?
And we cannot forget how every possible chance he could, he would insult Brett's parents.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So he had that, and he had other matches too. There was a Savage match in 93 that was on Coliseum Video that I thought was really fun because it was Lawler and Savage working against each other in WWF. Yeah.
And they were the same feud also along with the McMahon thing in Memphis as well.
Yeah, that was the year before. Yeah, when they brought, well, not the same year, when they brought Sherry in, and Savage was a heel. And Sherry and Savage ran together again. Yep. So, yeah, so they had that going on. And just other stuff he would do, you know, whether it be working with the Jake feud may not have been, you know, match-wise, not nearly as good, but it was entertaining for what it was, although sometimes it would cross the line. I enjoyed the stuff with him and Brian Christopher against the Putskis. I thought that was fun for what it was.
I was there for that. I was there for their tag match with the Putskis against Lawler and Christopher in San
Antonio. So there's that, and there's other stuff too. Yeah, you can't compare his WF run to his Memphis run, no doubt. I mean, it's just totally different things. But when it comes to, you know, being, you know, what he was, I think he deserves to be on the list somewhere. Where, I don't know particularly, but I think he deserves to be on the list.
I would say, though, that the Warrior feud did piss me off. When he, remember when he did the painting of Warrior? Because
yes.
People don't know, Jerry is a really great artist.
Absolutely.
Okay. And he'd done a painting of Warrior. Well, Warrior destroys the painting and lays waste to Lawler. And it was weird because he was supposed to be the face, but it was like, dude, he made a painting for you. And that's how you're going to disrespect him?
And then then Warrior's gone like the next week later. Too.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So anyway, I just had to throw that in there. I was pissed off at Warrior, man. And I might, you know what, just for that feud, I'm going to take Warrior off my list. He's no longer number one. Steve, what impressions of Lawler and WWF?
A couple of highlights that haven't been mentioned. Early 1995, after the Rumble, they did a battle royal on Superstars where Lawler lands on one foot outside of the ring and is hopping around for several minutes, telling the crowd to shut up so he can get away with this hustle. Until Bret Hart comes from the back and pops him in the mouth. He takes the big bump. The crowd goes nuts, all that horse shit. But just it was one of those subtle performances by him that just stole the show, even though he wasn't even in the ring at the time. Later that year in 95, when they did the Bret Hart, Isaac Yankum cage match, Jerry Lawler in the shark cage above the ring.
That's right, yeah.
Making his nose bleed and falling on camera, just great stuff. And one more was when Bret Hart was wrestling Bam Bam Bigelow on Raw in 93 with Stu and Helen in the crowd in the balcony, and Lawler actually walked up there with a cordless microphone to harass them face to face. Just hilarious stuff.
That's right. I'm gonna throw another one out there, and I believe it was when Lawler decked Ted DiBiase Jr. in the mouth with one of the greatest punches of all time. Do y'all remember that?
Yes.
And we'll just pretend the Michael Cole feud never happened, okay? So it never happened. It does not exist.
Yeah, the okay? lowlights were the Cole feud, and I would also argue the Jake Roberts stuff in 96.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, that's probably why he's not in my top 10, because he did have some lowlights, you know? I mean, I don't blame Lawler. Clearly, Lawler has carried some horrible wrestlers to good and horrible non-wrestlers to good matches over the years. Michael Cole, unfortunately, wasn't one of them. Couldn't stand that Mania feud. I just dreaded it. Just knowing that he was so close to the world title and we could have had John Cena versus Jerry Lawler. It would have been a great match instead of that garbage that we got with the Miz. Anyway, sorry. So where would he land on your list, though, Steve?
He's making the list. I'm going to have to explore a bit further because, personally, it's hard for me to differentiate between the Memphis run that occurred at the same time as the WWF stuff because I was going to the shows Tuesday night and watching both shows week to week. So it all kind of blends together with me. I'm going to have to take a step back and watch some of that 93 stuff again to get a clear picture. But he has a chance to crack my top 50 for sure.
Well, to me, I look at it as it was so unique at the time to kind of do that multi-promotion thing. Same thing with the ECW feud, is I look at that as an extension because they were feeders for WWE anyway. That I look at it as an extension of that feud. Like it was one big promotional deal. You know what I mean? Vince McMahon goes on Memphis TV as Vince McMahon, then, you know, I'm going to credit that as part of the run. I've never seen anything like that before.
And he also was able to, you mentioned Vince, he did the same thing with Bret Hart when Bret came down for a couple of shots. Bret comes on USWA TV doing the Andy Kaufman style, you know, these people are from Memphis, Tennessee kind of interview. Yep. And they were able to turn me against Bret just for those shows, even though he was my favorite wrestler. And then the following weekend, I was back on Bret Hart's team watching WWF. It was the best damn manipulation they could have done. It was crazy.
Look at you, man. You're a young, impressionable mind, man. God.
I was 11 years old, man.
There you go. There you go. All right. Let's move on to the next guy on our list. And this is one of my favorites. Another one of the best wrestlers ever. Enormously great tag team wrestler. I like him better as a babyface, and that's Goldust. Now, before I go into what I like about Goldust, Chris, make the case for Goldust being deserving on this list in the WWE, whatever.
The fact that Dustin Rhodes was able to transform himself from being the Natural, from being Dusty's son in WCW, to, you know, that whole shtick he had there, to becoming Goldust and becoming one of the most memorable characters of his generation is a true testament to the greatness of Dustin Rhodes as a performer. Again, WCW, he was one of the best workers in the world, no doubt. And then he comes to WWF and completely, like I said, transforms himself into another being altogether. And still, when he wrestles, he's still great, you know, when he's given the opportunity to. But he was able to incorporate that shtick and that gimmick into his matches, and it made him stand out from just about everything else that was going on at the time. Whether it was his feud with Undertaker or the stuff with Ahmed Johnson or the stuff of Roddy Piper, that WrestleMania street fight, people still talk about that. You know how it was, which, you know, was supposed to be him and Razor. So the Goldust Razor feud, you know, Razor run with all the machismo, and Goldust is, you know, coming on to him and making him uncomfortable. Just great booking, and Marlena being, you know, a key part of that as well in the early run. They were so great together. And, of course, they would eventually turn Goldust babyface. And he still did okay, but he wasn't the same. And then, you know, they went to the other direction when Russo got more power and he became all these different other characters, which was entertaining.
The artist formerly known as Goldust.
The artist formerly known as Goldust, which was entertaining. But when it came to actual inside-the-ring wrestling, it was nowhere near the level of Dustin Rhodes. You know,
I will say this though, Chris, and I'm going to interrupt here only to defend this era, because I've been watching a lot of his Attitude Era matches, like TV matches. But the problem isn't with Dustin's wrestling ability at this time. The problem is with Russo.
Well, yeah, I mean, he can still go.
It was 2-3-4 minute matches with run-ins, with, you know, DQ garbage finishes.
Oh, absolutely.
It had nothing to do, because when he was actually wrestling, the matches were actually pretty good. He was kind of hurt, though, during this time by getting little to no reaction during this Attitude Era run. But continue.
Yeah, and then, of course, they did the deal, you know, where they tried to you know, humanize them some, and it wasn't what you really wanted to see, because you wanted to go, you wanted Goldust, and then of course he has all of his personal issues and leaves, and eventually comes back, you know, in 2002 as Goldust, and has been with them off and on since. And when he's there, he's still so good. And in recent years, he got back in tremendous shape. And whenever they let him do his thing, he goes out there and shows that, I mean, this guy should be used as one of the top guys. He's got still got the talent. And I'm glad. I'm so glad that they've gone back and brought the old Goldust back now in this feud of R-Truth. Yeah, I know it's R-Truth. But the fact that they're doing the segments, where the Shattered Dream Productions segments, and he's back to the old school movies Goldust. I'm really happy with that, and I hope whenever they have their match, that both those guys go out there and give it their all. I know Goldust will, and hope Truth will too, because they're doing a really good job of building that feud up. But when it comes to the transition of WWF from cartoony WWF to Attitude Era WWF, Goldust has to rank up there near the top of the guys who made that transition possible. And that gets him definitely a great spot on the list for me.
Like where? We're like, off the top of your head, like not making you commit to this ranking, where do you think you
could, He's definitely in the top 50. Maybe top 25.
Okay.
I mean, there's so many. There's so many eras and guys that this guy could consider. So, but he's definitely top 50.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Steve, do you want to mention any highlights, lowlights, whatever that Chris might have missed before I wrap this up on Goldust?
As far as longevity goes, Dustin Rhodes at this point has had a longer career than Dusty did, which is wild to think about. I think you guys hit most of the good spots with him. He's a hell of a performer, underrated. He's become one of the all-time greats, really, when you really examine his work. He's probably a top 30 guy for me.
Okay, well, I'm gonna mention a few other things. Chris mentioned that he's a great tag worker. Just some matches for y'all to look at. There was a time when Booker T and Goldust were feuding with Chris Jericho. Was it who's Jericho's tag partner?
Christian.
And Christian. Some awesomely great matches. And I wanted to really point this out. Goldust as a heel was pretty good. I mean, he played his character really well. When you talk about character work, promos, Dustin's on point as a Goldust character. Even that kind of like a blurry artist formerly known as Goldust, a blurry line shoot promo Dustin, all of that stuff was really great. Like Dustin knew how to deliver that stuff and play it right. But when he was playing weak link in that Booker team, where like the team would disband if they didn't win the championship, he had the crowd in the palm of his hand, man. He is one of the greatest babyface tag team wrestlers of all time, bar none. And then with the Cody tag team, you know, actually made Cody Rhodes into a really good wrestler. As we mentioned on the first show, Steve, you know, I give all of the credit in the world to Goldust on that. And then even making R-Truth, I don't want to call him important or relevant, but interesting again with this current run. Another feud that I absolutely loved during the Attitude Era was the Val Venus feud with, you know, the porn star, you know, coming on to his wife. And they worked a match on pay-per-view that year that I absolutely love, because it sort of revolves around, you know, Goldust kicking Val Venus in the junk. You know, what's his corner spot called? Is that Shattered Dreams?
Yeah.
Shattered Dreams. Love that feud. Absolutely love the hell out of that feud. And the Orton match, we had mentioned wasn't it Goldust versus Orton to keep Dusty's job or something, or Dusty in the company, or what was the feud?
They started with the singles and then ended up working tags with the Shield maybe after that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. That's a blurry time for me. But as a heel, I think the one thing that hurt him was that he changed his style of wrestling. And not that it's always a bad thing, but he's so much better as a face in the ring than he is as a heel. And there's also highlight TV matches with Jerry Lawler, for one. They had a great, like, 10-minute run. Had decent matches with Steve Austin. And I just had it on the tip of my tongue. I just watched it. It was a great feud. Oh, the Brian Pillman feud. I'd always thought that the matches were subpar. I went and rewatched the two pay-per-view matches. It was SummerSlam and Bad Blood 97. The SummerSlam match was a decent match, and it had a botched ending. I don't know if y'all remember they botched the sunset flip.
Yes.
But the match itself was fine. The Bad Blood match, actively great match. I love that match. And so I recommend anyone to go rewatch that Bad Blood match between Pillman and Goldust. Really good match that people go out of their way to watch. So
I don't want to be that guy, but to chime in real quick, that would have been ground zero. The Bad Blood is when they found Pillman's body. So don't watch that match.
Oh, shit. Are you serious?
Yeah.
No, hey. Anyone who's listened to me over the years knows that, you know, half the time I don't know anything. And I don't know what I'm talking about. So, you know, no, please correct me, okay? Because I'm going to make about 100 more mistakes on this show alone.
And that changed the trajectory of Goldust altogether. Because if Pillman lives, that angle goes on because they were, you know, really getting going with that angle. And then he dies and they have to they have to bring Marlena back to Goldust. And then that's when they start doing the artist formerly known as Goldust. Not too long after that.
Yeah. You know what? To be honest though, man, I kind of liked him and Luna as like a duo, you know?
They went out there and performed. That's for sure.
See, yeah, I did too, but I liked earlier in 97 when he first turned babyface because he was doing a lot of the Dustin Rhodes mannerisms for the first time as Goldust, and it made for a fun kind of combination character.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he really is one of the best babyfaces ever, like bar none. He really is. So I'm going to tell you guys point blank, man. I've been playing with this list for the last couple of weeks. I have him top 10, like right at 10. You know, I have him above much bigger stars, just because he's been consistently great in the ring and a consistently great character for so long. Never kind of had that main event run that the other guys did, but just a quality wrestler all around. Another woulda, coulda, shoulda been much bigger than they ever pushed him. So anyway, so guys, that's the first half of our show. Let's take a quick break. We're going to hear from the Place to Be Nation. And when we come back, we're going to run down the six more guys, and then we'll wrap it up. You're listening to the Place to Be Nation.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which of course includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse. the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA on-demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuitas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Okay, welcome back to the new podcast series, For Your Consideration. I'm Will from Texas, and I'm here with my buddies Chris Zellner and Steve Williams. And we're running down the early 1990s and the new generation era for the greatest WWE wrestler ever poll here at Place to Be Nation. And guys, let's jump right into our next wrestler we're going to discuss, and that's Vader. And Steve, you made it a point before the show that you wanted to talk about Vader. So I'm going to let you talk about the highs and lows of Vader in WWF.
Vader's highs and lows were the same thing for me, and that's Shawn Michaels. He worked a very good match for Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam that year. For whatever reason, he rubbed Shawn the wrong way, and then it was never the same after that. I believe he was supposed to win the title at some point at the end of 96. It's the only way that the title of In Your House It's Time would actually make sense, because you know it would be Vader time. Instead, he somehow ends up out of the mix, and Sid versus Brett lines that show for some damn reason. As far as angles go, he had the big angle with Gorilla Monsoon right after the 96 Rumble that was really kind of revolutionary for its time. People didn't really put their hands on authority figures like that. That was an excuse to get him off the off TV for a bit. As lowlights, there was the match with Kane in the spring of 1998 where he calls himself a fat piece of shit.
Absolutely not surprising at all.
And then is essentially jobbed out for the rest of the year, another 6 months or so before he goes back to Japan. But he's one of those guys I felt that never got a fair shot in the WWF. Coming off of doing great work, 92, 93, 94 in WCW, runs into Hogan in 95, and I was really looking forward to him jumping to WWF to get a fresh start. And unfortunately, it just didn't quite materialize. I don't know if he was hurt by then or if it's just low morale from dealing with the politics in a new company. But he has a decent shot of making my list just based on personal bias. I would have liked to have seen him get more of a run. Showing up a little bit later, he had the deal where he fell on his ass on pay-per-view in the mid-2000s. But then after that, he did come back for a little squawk with Heath Slater around the time of Raw 1000. Right. But for all intents and purposes, you're looking at 96 to 98 is what would have been his prime WWF years.
Right. And what'd you think of him as like a promo, man? I didn't think Vader was a great promo. I thought he had great presence, just not a great promo. I just never thought, like, you know, and then Jim Cornette was his manager for a while, or Paul Bearer, I know, interfered on his behalf in like the Taker series, but I always thought Vader and Harley Race were a better duo than anything Vader did in WWF.
Yeah, Vader was more of a throwback monster, and Harley was very much a throwback personality too, so they really meshed well. One underrated Vader performance, probably his last great performance in the U.S., was the Final Four match in Chattanooga in 1997. He got busted open hard way in the first 2 minutes with an Undertaker chair shot, and he's bleeding like a damn gunshot victim the rest of the match, and just puts in a hell of a match. So that's one, for those of you who don't recall that match, February 97, please go check that out.
Yeah, that was a great match. I actually enjoyed the Undertaker series too. I thought Undertaker had his working boots on in those matches.
The Canadian Stampede, he had a good match with Taker.
I thought the Rumble 97 match was pretty good too. The problem I found with a lot of Vader matches around this time, not a lot of heat. Vader just never got over in WWF the way he did in WCW. Just didn't, you know. Just was not over to the degree that he was there, you know.
Yeah, then, Shawn Michaels was not sacrificing himself to Vader the same way Sting did in 92.
Right, exactly. And another match people should look out for is the I think it was Royal Rumble 98, the Goldust match.
Oh, so much fun.
Another really fun, great Vader WWF match that people should check out. So is he on your list, or
He's in my Explorer column right now. He has a chance, but I don't know if he'll make the cut.
Okay, well, that's fair. I think I'm in the same boat. He's a big maybe for me. Chris, your impressions of Vader in WWF?
I just thought it was a big flop. Because, I mean, he was so great in WCW and pushed in a way that he was just this huge monster. And yeah, that shit happened with Orndorff in the locker room where he got his ass kicked, and then he got fired, and it just, that changed the aura of him. And then they brought him in, and they did do a hot angle to bring him in, you know, the whole Gorilla Monsoon thing that, like Steve mentioned. And then he comes back, and they do the stuff with Sean, and Sean, like was said, did not do his best work of trying to sell Vader as being a guy worthy of actually being in the ring with him, I guess you would say. And, I mean, he does some decent matches and some good stuff in the ring, but he just kind of felt out of place. He was a guy who just, he didn't seem like he belonged in WWF, which is funny because he's a big guy, and WWF was home of the big guys. But he just didn't seem like a guy that was somebody that they would have. I don't know. He felt like this is a WCW guy playing, pretending to be a WWF guy.
Okay.
And there were guys like that on both. There were guys that went, there were WWF guys that when they were WCW that they were pretending to be WCW.
Well, like Boss guys Man that, or someone like that, you know.
Yeah, and then there were guys in WCW that were like pretending when they went to WWF pretending to be WWF. So it didn't work for me. Great action figure, though. I love this Jax figure. But other than that, yeah, he's not going to make my list.
Okay, and that's fair. Like I said, he's on the bubble for my list. I think Steve's in the same boat.
If it's WCW list, he's high ranking.
Oh, yeah.
But not WWF.
Absolutely. We're going to go to a guy I wanted to explore just because we've talked about Memphis on this show. And this guy infuriates me because in Memphis, legitimately great wrestler. Loved watching him in Memphis in the early 90s. Absolutely despise him in WWF, and that's Jeff Jarrett, okay? And for me, he kind of has two highlights in the WWF, and that's the Shawn Michaels match, the In Your House pay-per-view match. Great match. Absolutely worked kind of like in a Memphis style, accentuated Jarrett's strengths as a wrestler. And we already mentioned the X-Pac haircut versus hair match from SummerSlam 98. After that, I have nothing good to say about this guy. I kind of, in a way, didn't mind the country singer gimmick, where he was where he was doing the Milli Vanilli gimmick, you know, where he had a Road Dogg actually was the one who was recording the song. What was it? Be My Baby Tonight?
With My Baby Tonight.
Whatever the song. I mean, does it really matter? No, but you know what I mean. Like, I didn't mind that, but I thought, like, when Bret Hart, because you remember, Jeff Jarrett popped up right as Bret Hart popped up in WCW, you know? And I remember sitting around with my friends watching this stuff saying, WCW got Bret Hart and WWF got Jeff Jarrett. You got to be kidding me, you know? And you know, it turns out Jarrett probably had a better run in WWF than Hart did in WCW. But that's neither here nor there. The point being is I hated his shoot interviews. He talked about Goldust's little pseudo shoot interviews. I hated Jarrett's shoot interviews at the time. I hated his character as the guitar smashing misogynist. Hated it. It's something that he's ran with for the last, 18, 19 years. Sick of it. Can't stand it. I wish this guy would go away. I know a lot of people credit him with getting China over. I would say that Chris Jericho did more to get China over as a credible wrestler than Jeff Jarrett did. Just hated that feud. I hated the fact that he would smash guys with the guitar. I thought they were wasting Owen Hart by having Owen in a tag team with Jarrett. Absolutely cannot stand this guy. I'm glad they never brought him back. Unfortunately, he's kind of a stained every promotion he's been with, i.e. TNA. So I'm done with WCW when he went back. I hate him. No shot at making my list. And I think it's sad because he was a really good wrestler. So having said all that, Chris, thoughts on Jeff Jarrett's WWF run?
What a big difference between Memphis. With Memphis, he was a babyface. And WWF, he was heel for almost his entire run. And Jarrett was he really grew into the character and became a really good heel character. But in the ring, he was so much more adept at being a babyface. I mean, he's a classic babyface worker. He did okay. And you could definitely tell he was ripping off Lawler and stuff like that and stuff he had seen. And for heel stuff inside the ring, it just didn't feel right. It felt like somebody pretending to be somebody they weren't in a lot of ways. But I was always entertained by Jarrett and Double J stuff. Then when he comes back, and you talk about the shoot interview, the little pseudo shoots, that was leading to the NWA angle, and that was horrible. NWA North America champion Jeff Jarrett, that was not good at all. And then, I was glad when they decided, well, fuck it, let's make him Double J again, which led to him singing with Sawyer Brown on that one pay-per-view, singing Some Girls Do, which I love that moment. But when Jeff cut his hair and changed his look, I kind of liked Jeff at the time, but I could see where people would not have liked that whole deal. But and he had an acrimonious departure from the company, holding Vince up. And the whole deal with China. China was over for Jeff Jarrett. I mean, I understand where you're going with that as far as like a credible wrestler, but she was way more before that whole deal happened. But when it comes to making my list, no, Jeff's not going to be on this list, no. Steve?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I am not a huge Double J fan either in Memphis or WWF. I liked his 96 heel run in Memphis after he just abruptly left WWF, but that's not under consideration here. He's just kind of an okay work rate guy, not exceptional. Okay character guy, not exceptional. He's just the definition of mediocre for me in that run.
Yeah, and you were a guy who was in Memphis, the Memphis area, Louisville, that you saw him there. It's just the world's different performer.
Oh, yeah. It's funny, in Memphis, he was the world's ugliest pretty boy, and they made it work. He had been a career babyface up to that point, turned heel in Memphis literally weeks before he got called up to WWF. It's just odd that it would bring him up to do something entirely different than what he'd been doing his whole career.
Yeah. And he was able to bring in, you know, Ronnie P. Gossett was around at one point. Of course, Robert Fuller came in as Tennessee Lee.
Yes.
So we did get that, but wow. it was so different from what was there, you know, what we had seen in Memphis. Like I said, it goes back to me saying he was pretending to be somebody he was.
See, and when I started watching Memphis, he was feuding hot and heavy with Brian Christopher at the time. And to me, Brian was such a more of a dynamic personality than Jarrett was even back then. I never have gone back and revisited or even, you know, gone into the build up to some of that. It's just,
well, that's a legendary feud.
I hated that Brian was stuck in purgatory for obvious reasons for all those years, while Jeff was on the national stage, just not cutting the mustard.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff and Brian in 93 had a tremendous feud.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely, and they were made for each other. That could have been the Lawler-Dundee of the 90s if, you know, Jeff hadn't have gone to WWF. If Jeff had decided, well, I'm gonna be like Jerry and stay in Memphis, you know, him and Brian could have done it all there, you know, just kept going back to the well. They would have been partners, couldn't then turn on each other. And they say, no, that was the Lawler-Dundee feud of the 90s. But again, Jeff went, and Brian should have went earlier than he did, and that didn't happen. But that's a whole nother story for another time. Will dropped off real quick, but so we're going to keep on going as we can with our next guy, which is a guy that I had on my list to bring up on this, and that is Yokozuna. I did a show with my friend Alan Forel on Dr. Keith Presents on figure4online.com. We did a show about Yokozuna, going over his entire career. And Yokozuna, when he came in WWF, I was like, I know this guy from somewhere. He's familiar. And then I put it together. Like, oh man, that's Kokina. And people were confused when he debuted. They thought that he was Akebono, the guy in Japan. Yeah, so there was confusion going around. They did a good job of hiding his identity for a while, and then it finally came out. And then it didn't really help the cause that whenever they would align him with the Head Shrinkers, that they would do all their Samoan stuff in the rain together. Like their ritual stuff. So that kind of like blew that away. But in a time when they're changing the look of their performers, WF, because he comes in at the end of 92. Steroid testing is now big time. There's no doubt about it. He wasn't on these steroids.
Oh, no.
No, there was no doubt about that. So he comes in and they give him the monster heel push. And he becomes a champion. They do the WrestleMania with him and Brett. And then Hogan beats him for the title. You know, whether you like it or not, it was what it was. And then they do the King of the Ring deal where, you know, Yokozuna wins it back with the old fireball gimmick from the photographer. And it was, which was supposed to set up Hogan Yokozuna rematch at SummerSlam, which didn't happen. And because Hogan left. And that's when they, you know, did the whole Lex Luger turn and the Lex Express. And led to the big SummerSlam match. And it just didn't work. But that wasn't Yokozuna's fault.
Oh, no.
So he kept going on. And the natural feud was to put him against The Undertaker. So they put him against The Undertaker. And I thought they had really good matches together. They did some, the silly angles, of course.
with the Undertaker, you know, being killed and descending to the heavens, and then you know, coming back eventually, and they bring the feud back, and Chuck Norris is involved.
That's Walker, Texas Ranger, man. He's the king of syndication around these parts.
Yeah. So they do that, and it seems like after they get through with the Undertaker feud, they really don't know what to do with him, so they put him with Owen. And him and Owen, I thought, as a tag team, was a fun tag team because it was a different type of group, because Owen's the flashy, high flyer guy, but in this tag team, he could be like the obnoxious prick with the big guy backing him up, kind of like what Sean Waltman was in NWO. So he could sell this stuff, but he's got the big man with him. And then Yoko grows the beard, which, you know, gives him an edge. And, you know, it's really getting good, but he starts gaining more and more weight. Right. And he's not able to move around as good as he used to. And then that just completely falls apart in 1996 when they, you know, turn him babyface with the Vader situation. And he just never the same again. But I think he's a guy that definitely should be on this list somehow, some way. He's definitely going to be in the top half of my list. Steve, I don't know where you fall in line, but what were your thoughts on Yokozuna?
You know, something that's overlooked, and I might be wrong on this, but just kind of going from memory, I think he's only the second, well, third if you want to count Slaughter. Yeah, this is already falling apart. But one of the few long-term heel champions they had. You had Graham in the late 70s, and Slaughter had a little bit of a run. Savage was heel the last 2 months of his title run. But other than that, I can't remember anybody that was a heel champion for just more than a few weeks before
Yoko.
Exactly
right. Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, he put together a decent little run at a time when there wasn't a lot of talent for him to work with. Match with Lex Luger is, you know, if you would just hear those two names, you'd think that match would be as good as it is. Yoko was flexible for a big fat guy. He had some athleticism to him.
Absolutely.
The team with Owen, as you said, was good. They were an underrated team at another time when WWF just did not have good teams. They still were able to put together good matches with the Guns and a decent match with Luger and Davey Boy in summer of 95. I thought it was odd when they broke the team up, they never did a singles Owen versus Yoko match on a big show. Instead, they transitioned to first Yoko versus Davey Boy at that February 96 show. And then they were going to go with Yoko and Vader. And that's when Yoko's career just kind of fell apart and they never had the big blow off match. But he's definitely somebody that's on my, probably going to make my list. I got him on my Explore session right now. I know a match that Rob Naylor points to is a Yokozuna versus 1-2-3 Kid match. It was a very good cat and mouse kind of match that I'm looking forward to
rewatching. Oh, yeah. Those two seem like they would have good chemistry against each other, no doubt.
Yeah, but he was, like I said, heel dominant champion at a time when that was not a common thing. It was much more of a NWA thing than a WWF. And I think he held himself well, all things considered.
All right, so where do you think he ends up on your list?
He'd be probably bottom third.
Okay. I can understand that. I can see that. But I think that to leave him off of a top 100 list, I just think would be, I'm going to say asinine, but ill-advised, I guess would be the word I would use. I think he should definitely be on the list, no doubt.
Yeah, I implore our listeners to look into his work just because he was on top in such a dark period for the company. So a lot of people may have missed his best stuff. A lot of people may have lapsed and then come back during the Attitude Era and may have missed the entire Yokozuna run. He's definitely worth delving into a bit.
And then, you know, and in the Attitude Era, it was the whole deal Yokozuna, it became like a punchline because it was rumored he was going to be on Nitro every week.
So,
oh man,
because
just last week, I'm sure Hulk Hogan drove by the gravesite and laid on top to count to three to get his damn pin back after all these years.
We just mentioned in Between the Sheets recently on the King of the we talked about King of the 93. Is that Hogan never got his win back on Yokozuna, and that was always the reason why he was always talking about him coming back, because Hogan wanted to get that win back and it never happened.
Yeah, I'm sure he brought Earl Hebner with him to that gravesite to count to three, and he could finally shake that ghost off him, man.
Oh my God.
I'll be honest with you, fellas. Yokozuna, over the last few years, has become one of my favorite wrestlers of this era. I mean, y'all covered the highlights, the Owen and the Owen tag team and the Bret Hart matches. But I love the fact that this guy, who was like probably a legitimate 500 pounds, was able to keep pace with those guys, where you assume someone that big would just lumber around, and he did, man. I mean, he was flying and taking huge bumps and giving big bumps as well. So I love Yokozuna. I think his character fit perfectly for that particular era. And what I mean by that is, I don't think like you could pass off a Samoan as a Japanese sumo wrestler now, right? I mean, do you disagree with that?
No, I mean, you can't, you couldn't do that now. And like we mentioned a while ago, it's tough to do that then too. You know, because people were thinking that, you know, this, I remember like we said that people were talking about he was Al Cabono. I thought he was like Chad Rowan.
Right. Yeah. And you couldn't do that now. But I love Yokozuna. I actually have him like close to the top 50, I think. I think he probably cracks my top 50 because those Bret matches were insanely great. And, let's move on to our next guy. And Steve, you picked. Who'd you pick, Steve? Owen Hart. My bad. I had a brain fart there. And so I'm going to let you talk about Owen Hart for a few minutes.
All right. Owen Hart, to me, is one of those guys who obviously insanely talented at a time where there wasn't a whole lot of work ready type guys in WWF. The way he passed away, I think, kind of paints his image and almost like a rose-colored glasses kind of thing. I think a lot of people overrate Owen a bit. Not that I think he was bad, but I don't see him as a top 10 guy like some people would. Obviously, you have the stuff with Bret as highlights, the great match with Davey Boy in 97. He's the kind of guy who you could put in with just about anybody, and he could have a good to great match. That great sprint with the 1-2-3 Kid at King of the Ring 94 is another example of him having a good match with a smaller opponent. I think he benefited greatly from being around at a time when the big steroid guys all had to disappear and you had to start building around work rate guys. So you have him, you have Bret, you have Shawn as kind of the work rate nucleus for a while there in the mid-90s. It would have been interesting to see how he would have evolved had he survived past 1999, because you get into just a few months later, Chris Jericho shows up, and then the next year you have, you know, Benoit, Guerrero, all those guys. So, yeah, I think it would be – he's another interesting what-if for me. I think he's very good. He'll probably land somewhere in the middle of my pack.
Yeah, I have him in the middle as well. Every time I watch an Owen match, he goes up a little bit because I think he's a great TV worker. Mm-hmm. But then he'll come down a little bit when I see, like, a particularly, like, bad promo. I don't think he was a great promo. What would you say about his promo skills, Steve?
I agree. He was – kind of forced. I mean, you could tell that just personality wise he's kind of a goofy bastard, and he was trying to play this despicable heel, but at the same time he's just yucking it up a little bit too much. My favorite is the Rumble 94 after he turns on Bret and he's cutting this terrible promo with mucus all over his face. It's just the dirt worst possibility, the combination of things that could have happened for his breakthrough moment.
Yeah, I don't know. I was kind of I never believed Owen. I think I don't know, Chris. Do you ever like feel like you believed Owen as a character? Like I always felt like he was acting, and not a particularly great actor.
Owen wasn't a guy that should have been pushed as a serious heel threat as far as, like I said, being serious. Yeah, definitely. He was at his best when he was, you know, goofing around the whole, when he was doing the slammy deal, when carrying the slammy trophy all over the place and parading it around and acting like, you know, that's the greatest thing of his life. That was Owen Hart.
Okay, I have to interrupt just because we're just to make a mental note for myself. We're gonna disagree on that point. So
really,
because I hated the slammy thing.
But that's when he was at his best as a character. When he was annoying. Okay. I mean, he wasn't trying to be like the serious heel Owen Hart. He was just being an annoying douchebag, you know. So that's where he worked at his best in that role. A prick, you know, like Gilbert.
I get it. Because I was actually going to use that and the Owens a Nugget era, like I guess when he was hanging out with the Nation, as kind of examples of when I didn't believe him. You know what I mean? Like, and that's to me, I believed him as the snotty brat, like you said, little brother of Brett. I think that's why that feud worked, right? Because he was a great brat. But like, outside of that, or like maybe when he came back and beat up Shawn Michaels after the Montreal incident. I think those are the two highlights of his character, but I would argue that the slammies is a little, that's just a disagreement though. I mean, it's no big deal. Continue.
But that plays into his real life self. That's what Steve was saying. That's when he's more like real life Owen than like trying to pretend to be something he's not, like you were trying to say.
Yeah. Well, maybe I just went like real life Owen. he is. I mean, hell, he is Canadian after all.
I mean, he was known as the big prankster and jokester, and somebody that like that, not a guy that you believed was in a blood feud that was wanting to, you know, seriously injure somebody. That comes off as playing. Now, inside the ring, though, I mean, yeah, he had a lot of really strong TV matches, like you said. Some really good pay-per-view matches. The feud with Brett, of course, you know, was probably him at his best. We talked about him and Yoko earlier as a tag team. Very, very good tag team together. Underrated, in my mind, at least.
I love the Yoko tag team. I do not love the Jarrett tag team.
No. And him and Davey were good together as well. He just, Owen peaked early, and then it seemed like he kind of coasted for a while. And it wasn't his fault. They just pushed him down to mid-card. He had the stuff of Austin, which was interesting, especially, you know, playing off the tombstone.
Hold on. Let me ask you about that, though. Instead of just mentioning it, does that push him down? And then after you answer, I want Steve to answer. Does that push him down a little bit for you? You know, like injuring Austin?
Not really. It doesn't have an effect on me because I've seen that move used many times before by different people. You know, it was just an accident, a freak accident. You know, I've seen Scott Steiner use that move quite a few times. Don Morocco used that same type of tombstone at times. I've seen it happen. It just one of those things. I could understand why Austin was pissed, definitely, but you know, it just was one of those things. So no, I don't think it affected me. No.
What about you, Steve? Would something like that, like, be, I mean, because we argue on, you know, in other cases, you know, we did it with Ahmed, like, you know, someone being careless in the ring hurts them. I mean, those. It's pretty. I mean, Austin was adamant that Owen was being careless in that botch.
Yeah, if it happened all the time, that'd be one thing. But as far as that's the only real injury I can think of Owen hurting anyone.
That's probably true.
And Austin himself, didn't he do that same thing to Mazzacchino once and hurt his neck?
Yes, it was a pile driver.
Oh, so that's the easy answer. It's karma. It was karma coming back to fight Austin. Yes,
but I think Owen though. Owen's thing is that people look at him more fondly because of what happened to him and just the way he was, his personality. That's part of it. But as far as my ranking goes, he'll be in the he won't be below 50. So he'll be in that probably that 30s, 40s area for me.
Okay. No, and that's like I said, I'm still like kind of exploring though, and I've seen all the big pay-per-view matches. I'm kind of looking at the TV matches from on a week-to-week basis. I think someone said that he was like the best TV worker of his era, and I was like, let me go look, because I mean, like with at least somebody like Rey Mysterio, like I could name like matches from specific years.
Yeah, but is this the best WWF TV worker? There's a difference now.
No, but what's wait? Okay, well, hold on. Before I go on, what do you mean? What there's a difference? I'm interested.
WWF
I'm not
television.
Telling you, I'm interested.
Yeah, in WWF television is definitely different scale than other television in that time period because they were still at the time heavy on squash matches. You didn't get a whole lot of very competitive matches on television.
No, Chris. I'm talking about Rey Mysterio in WWE. Like I'm comparing.
Well, you can't really compare because again, Rey didn't work squash matches like Owen did.
Okay. I'm not watching the squash match. I'm watching like the Raw matches, like because Owen did have featured Raw matches.
Yeah, but he didn't have the opportunity to have as many.
Okay, as Rey but I'm not worried about the amount so much as I am. The ones that he did he perform well? Like we know of the Bulldog match, right? They gave that match plenty of time. Or like with commercials taken out, it was probably like, what, 15 minutes, 16 minutes? So, you know, they probably had like a 20, 22-minute match, you know, if you consider commercial time or whatever. And so that was a great TV match, right? I want to see if he had other opportunities for great TV matches because, I mean, come on, Chris. There were plenty of Raw matches from, you know, 93 till I would say the end of 97 where we could look and say, hey, that was a great match or that they would give matches plenty of time. I mean, whether it was Goldust, Jerry Lawler, which got 10 minutes, you know, I mean, so I'm not going to let Owen off the hook because of the time period, because there are other matches we can point to that say, hey, these were highlights. Somebody told me to make sure I watched I think it was HBK versus Bulldog around that time period. There was the Stone Cold and Dude Love versus Stone Cold and Dude Love versus Owen and Bulldog, right? That tag match in San Antonio, the tag title change. I was there. That was a great match. So I want to explore and see if there are more out there before I can say he's the greatest TV worker of his era. I want to make sure, you know, that that's true. Like, I mean, with Rey, we can argue that Rey is without a doubt the greatest TV worker of his era from like 2004 till 2010. You know, I mean, he has the volume and he has the big matches. So I want to make sure Owen has those matches as well. Do you understand where I'm coming from? I'm not saying that he's going to have as many because there are just less hours of TV. You know, I'm saying that I want to explore that.
I didn't think he is the best TV worker of the year. I'm just saying it's different eras, though.
Yeah.
Well, different arguments.
No, but I'm saying of the era. That was the argument of that era.
Yeah, but what's the era, though? We're talking, I mean, are you counting Owen and Rey in the same era, though?
No, I'm not. No.
Okay,
comparison. That's bullshit. We can compare eras all the time. We can compare a match from 2010 to a match from 1994. You can do that. You can compare eras.
You can do it.
Time. I know, and it's valid too. I don't subscribe to that Meltzer bullshit thing where it says you have to be in that time, place, and take that in consideration. We've seen it all the time. Dude, you've worked on me on dozens of 80s projects where we see great
matches. All the same era too.
No, I'm saying, but great matches that we get excited about 30 years later. That's what I'm saying, because they're great matches. They hold up.
But I'm not comparing those matches to 2000s matches either.
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't either. I was comparing the idea that they're the best TV worker of their time. I'm saying if we're going to list Ray as the greatest worker from his time, 2005 to 2010, 2000, whatever, 2002 to 2010. Well, let's look at Owen from like, say, 92, 93 up until 98, 99. I'm not saying,
I mean, you can do anything you want.
I don't even think you understand what I'm saying. So let's move on. Anyway,
I mean, if you're going to compare, you compare Owens.
I'm trying to determine if he's the best TV worker of his time. I'm not comparing him to Rey Mysterio as a TV.
Okay.
Do you understand now that I'm not specifically comparing?
Well, I understand you brought up Rey, so I just want, was wondering why. If you're talking about Sting, or you're talking about Austin, or you're talking about whoever from Owens era, okay.
Yeah.
But Ray, that's why I was wondering where you was going with
this. We can definitely compare wrestlers from different eras, because that's the whole point of this project, to rank wrestlers from different eras. Having said all that, let's continue. Okay, so is there anything else, Steve, that you want to bring up about Owen before we move on to the next guy?
No, I just do want to point out, I thought they missed the opportunity at the end of 97 when he came back to attack Shawn. If they were ever going to do a quickie one-month title run, you know, December 97 to January 98 would have been the time to do it for Owen. I understand they had to get it on Austin at Mania, but I mean, I think Shawn cutting his balls off there really spelled the end of Owen as a headliner.
Yeah, and then the follow-up with Triple H at WrestleMania, where Owen got pinned clean as a sheet. You know,
and at Unforgiven, where he got pinned clean as a sheet again.
Yeah.
But that's Owen facing residual heat from Brett.
Oh, no, we get it, Chris. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, I mean, that's just all that is. It's sad that it was that way, but that's all it was.
Yeah. You know what? I was kind of sad that they didn't let the Brett-Owen tag team kind of run longer before they feuded. You know, because I think... Like, if we point out the Steiners tag that showed up, was only on Coliseum Video for the longest time. I think it's on a DVD. Is it on the Bret Hart DVD?
Yeah, it's been released.
It's on the Hart Family DVD.
Yeah.
Family DVD. Like, that kind of, like, I mean, by far the greatest match the Steiners ever had in you know, WWF. But it just kind of highlighted, like, man, you let these guys go, like Brett and Owen. Like, what a great tag team they were. Like, I didn't care for Owen Neidhart, were they the New Foundation?
Owen and Neidhart were the New Foundation. Exactly. And then Owen and Coco was High Energy.
That's right. And then Bulldog and Owen were heatless. You know, not a lot of heat in those matches. So I kind of wish that him and Brett would have teamed a little longer or more often. But, anyway, yeah, I'm kind of with you guys. I have Owen somewhere in the middle of the pack. Like I said, man, he's one of those guys where, like Goldust, I know he's top 10, right? Undoubtedly for me. But Owen kind of like Waltman, and he just keeps bouncing up and down my list depending on the different matchups. So anyway, let's move on to our next guy, and that is someone I wanted to point out, and that's Kevin Nash. And, you know, like, it would be real easy for me to just sit here and bash Kevin Nash, right? I mean, that's what the internet does, right? I'm not going to. You know, I when we look at this project, part of it is to look at, like, the character. And I think that, you know, he played a great lumbering bodyguard. You know, like, he was a valid bodyguard for Shawn Michaels, who was kind of like this little, like, gay stripper, you know? And Shawn Michaels played that role well, so he needed a bodyguard. Like, where was Kevin Nash when Shawn Michaels got beat up by those military guys, right? You know? It's kind of a bummer. But are you doing dishes? Someone doing dishes in the background?
That's my daughter. Sorry about that.
All right. It's all right, Steve. It's fine.
It sounds like you're doing it in a restaurant.
Hey, Chris, remember when we used to do those shows with Dean Rasmussen and you'd be washing dishes while we were talking?
Oh, yeah.
Like the whole.
Well, you know, I did a show with Rob Naylor when he ordered through the drive-thru.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and I've talked to Rob Naylor enough to know that I've been a part of that plenty of times. Anyway, so Kevin, you know, clearly, I mean, for me, I kind of liked his character, and I kind of liked when he was getting like an edge, kind of like the Kevin Nash that we would eventually see in WCW, like when he was like wearing the glove and, you know, he was just kind of getting meaner, and his little Billy Ray Cyrus mullet was starting to grow into that long mane of hair, you know, like I kind of wish we would have had more of that Nash. Clearly the highlights are, for me, it would have to be the Brett feud, right? Does anyone dispute that? Like,
no, the Brett that's feud? His best work.
Yeah. The Brett feud. And then the, good friends, bitter enemies match with Shawn Michaels, right?
Yeah, oh, easily.
Yeah, and he worked well with the Click members, right? Like when you got Sean, Razor, Diesel, and 1-2-3 Kid in the ring, any of those matchups could produce a really good match or a great match, right? I mean, those four worked well together. It's kind of like the problem I'm having with someone like Nash or a Razor Ramon even is you take their Click buddies out. It doesn't always connect, man. Like I'm really having a problem watching Razor Ramon, but Diesel, you know, has that Bret Hart feud. So I kind of have a dilemma. Like, do I credit that Bret Hart feud and those good matches all to Bret, or do I say, hey, you know, no, Diesel could go. You know, he was learning from his buddies. I think the lowest point would have to be the return, right, with the NWO.
Oh yeah,
I mean,
I mean, it's because he's remembered for tearing his quad.
Then though, like, he wasn't having any great matches. I mean, he had he was part of the horrible Hell in the Cell with Triple H.
They cut his hair and all that other stuff. Yeah, it wasn't
good. I mean, that
wasn't
good. I mean, like, I don't know. He feuded with Jericho, right?
Yes, it wasn't. It just, yeah, hit that run just was not
good. Yeah, so I mean, he was past his prime, and then the horrible return with CM Punk, like, just, man, how defeated was I when Nash powerbombed Punk, right, at SummerSlam, and then he clearly gets out of the feud with Punk, right, because he's probably going to have to job. So Triple H jobs Punk out and ruins kind of Punk's momentum, but, you know, whatever. I'm not bitter about that 6 years later. It's fine. You know, I'm still bitter about it anyway. So Kevin Nash is one of those guys. I have him on the bubble. I really have him kind of like, I think he has enough good stuff where if I was just looking at his highlights, I could probably squeeze him on, but man, he has some garbage too. So I'm going to throw it over to you, Chris, and talk about Kevin Nash.
I think the best Kevin Nash in WWF was 94 when he starts getting comfortable and forms a regular team with Shawn, and they have all those good matches, especially that Action Zone match with Razor. I think it's Action Zone or Mania, one of the two, with Razor and 1-2-3 Kid. And then the Kevin Nash after Survivor Series 95 to the end when he gets his edge back, you know, in the Royal Rumble, the feud with Undertaker. It seemed like he was being reborn as a character, and then he leaves. Because, God, that 95 run, the whole champion run, it was not good. Not good at all.
That was with the fight with the feud with Mabel, right?
Oh, God, yeah. That was definitely.
Point too. Yeah, that first one, absolutely.
Yeah, and it just, he wasn't believable. I mean, he wasn't believable in that role they were trying to put him in as making him this smiley, happy guy. I mean, yeah, Kevin Nash can be funny as hell and cut funny promos, but that wasn't it. He was just like this milquetoast guy, you know?
Absolutely.
It's what Vince tried to do with Roman Reigns at the beginning of when they broke up the Shield. You know, that's one of the reasons why Roman Reigns is in the position he's been in. It's because fans, the fans still won't let it go. The Survivor Series match with Bret, maybe his best match in his whole run in the WWF. And
yeah, you could argue that one that HBK match.
Yeah, and again, you know, I enjoyed him and the Undertaker. Their feud, the match at WrestleMania was not the best match in the world, but I enjoyed the feud because it was different. They hadn't worked together before, so it was different. The two big guys going against each other. You look at Undertaker's WrestleMania matches, over the years, that's like the first big Undertaker WrestleMania match, I think. I would say that one. That one was of the whole streak. So
yeah.
I enjoyed that. And the comeback in 2002. Yeah, the NWO, they just the way that it was booked was weird that the whole way. And then both Hall and Nash just, I don't know, they didn't seem like they were completely into it. It just didn't work out. But regarding placement on my list.
Would he make your list?
He may sneak in there. I have a soft spot for Kevin Nash. He may sneak in there bottom 10 or so.
I might have him right above Warrior 2, man. Like,
he may sneak in there.
I'm kind of.
But yeah, that's where I met with him.
What about you, Steve? Are you a Kevin Nash fan? Is he making your list?
Probably not. I mean, I will say that Kevin Nash, first quarter of 96, was the best character in North American wrestling. To the point where I think if Hall and Nash had jumped in 95 and did everything the same just a year earlier, the idea would not have been as successful as it was, because you had these.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, you had these Kevin Nash who had been presented as so damn edgy for 6 months, and then it's just hand delivered to Eric Bischoff and he hits a home run with it. Had it been Mr. Smiley, happy WWF champion hanging out with Jenny McCarthy, Kevin Nash, no, that was going to be too big of a jump.
Doing celebrity MTV softball tournaments.
Fucking rock and jock champion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you look at the lead into the title run, you had that 94 Rumble where he's the first guy I can remember who was pretty much made from a crowd reaction at a Royal Rumble in Providence.
That's very true, yes.
He put out, I think it was 7 guys, had the crowd going nuts for him. And people forget that Shawn Michaels pretty much took off between Mania and SummerSlam that year. So he was working ringside for all of Diesel's matches while he was Intercontinental Champion. I'm sure he was giving him pointers that whole time and helping him improve, you know, from the best seat in the house. But Chris pretty much hit the rest of my points about, you know, just pretty much being neutered the whole time he was champion and not really doing a damn thing productive during that time. The first time I went to Raw was in 95, and the main event was him and Sid in a cage match, and something I never want to think about again as long as I live.
Yeah, I'm glad we didn't put Sid on this list, man, because he just does not have very many highlights in WWF. So
yeah, why was Diesel in the softball tournament, not Sid?
I know, right? It seems like the natural fit.
He's the ringer.
Yeah, it's probably because Sid was probably running his own scam in Tennessee with his own little softball. You know, here he had to probably do it as like a celebrity guest, right? You know, for charity. Whereas at least in Tennessee, you know, he could probably collect fees and you know, get a cut of the concessions. You know, sell like lukewarm hot dogs and you know, sodas. So you know, so he was probably like, "Nah, man, there's no business in doing charity. You know, I need to do it on my own." So I think that's probably why Nash did. He's probably more charitable than Sid. You know.
Yep. Then you flip ahead to 2002 and you have the guy who literally tore his quad taking a step across the ring. He comes back looking like 1992 Sting. Then 10 years after that, he ruins the hottest angle they've had in years and then can't wrestle because he's on a blood thinner. I mean, just get the hell out of here. I don't have time for this guy.
Go away. Go away. I'm absolutely with you on that, man. It was such a damn. I don't know, man. That Punk return might just bump him off my top 100. Problem is, like, I've been working on this list for a few weeks now, and I have like 4 spots and 17 guys. And Kevin, you know, Kevin Nash is one of the last 17 guys I haven't eliminated yet. So I'm trying to see if I want to put him in there. I don't know, man. You know, that 2002 run, that CM Punk run, and then they had that garbage match with Triple H where all of a sudden he could wrestle again. Like, wait a minute, the blood thinner thing got worked out just in time for you to work with your buddy, you know?
Of course. Yeah.
Complete garbage.
Amazing.
Yeah. So anyway, let's talk about another stand-up human being. He's no longer with us, but Chris, this was your guy. You wanted to talk about it, you know, when coming up with like names for the show, I was thinking of like, okay, we could call it the New Generation, right? Because that was like their big push in the mid-90s. But this guy, you know, kind of started at the end of the rock and wrestling era. And so I might even call this show the Warrior Era, you know?
Well, he was part of he was in the New Generation era as well.
So I know he was in there, but he wasn't, but, you know.
Short time.
Yeah. I mean, his time had already passed. He had already kind of outlived his welcome. And that's the Ultimate Warrior. So why don't you run us through the highlights of his career and the low points, and then we'll go from there.
Well, I mean, Warrior came in. They didn't give him a mega push right away. And he won the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam 88. So he'd been there a year before he won the Intercontinental title, which he squashed Honky Tonk Man, ending that great run as champion. And then after that, they started to build him up more. He had the Andre feud, and which he was getting over on Andre, which nobody had ever done other than Hogan, really. And you could tell that they had big plans for him. And then he loses to Tyler Rube at Mania 5. And it's like, whoa, okay, interesting. But I'm a Rube guy, so I didn't mind it at all. And then Warrior got it back from him at SummerSlam. And Rude is easily Warrior's best opponent.
Yeah. No.
In WWF. No. I mean, you look at the Mania 5 and SummerSlam 89 and 90. And those two had the best matches against each other. And so, which is interesting that Warrior and Rude had such solid chemistry together.
Well, you got to.
And he was.
They worked together in Texas when Warrior was Dingo Warrior.
Very briefly, yeah. Because Rude left a couple of months into that run. Yeah. Right. So yeah, they had a history together, but it was just interesting to watch Warrior and Rude have these matches together when Hogan would refuse to work Rude, period. So, which is, he's the only guy that Hogan refused to work against.
Well, what was the story behind that? I don't know that.
Hogan didn't want any piece of Rude because Rude, being the legitimate tough guy.
Really?
Yes. Like, Hogan didn't want any. He thought Rude was a maniac. He didn't want any part of it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah. They may have worked like one or two house show matches. That's it.
Oh, shit.
So, yeah. If you wonder why Rude was never a contender for Hogan, that's why. But, eventually, they do the big deal with Hogan, and that's such an important match in the history of the World Wrestling Federation.
Wait, okay.
Yes. We talk about on Between the Sheets how huge it was. I mean, that was a huge match. And it was, for what it was a hell of a match. You know, is it still a 5-star match today? Probably not. But just the story that was told and everything involved there. It's one of Hogan's best matches past 1987, no doubt. And it made Warrior, although Hogan stole the heat at the end, but that's Hogan. So Warrior, you know, goes wrong from that. And this title run it's a disappointment because he really doesn't have anybody to feud with other than Rude. They do stuff with Perfect, but he's just not at that level at the time. Then with Rude, that was the only credible challenger they had. He was defending against like Bravo and Earthquake. Savage was tied up with Dusty.
Right.
And then once Savage gets through with Dusty, then they do the deal with Savage. And it led to the legendary Mania match after Warrior loses the belt to Slaughter at Royal Rumble. Where again, here's two straight WrestleManias that Warrior's in another one of the most legendary matches in the history of the promotion. So, yeah, were there stories involved that were bigger and involved, you know, Hogan and Savage? Yeah, but Warrior was in those matches and he held his own as far as what he needed to do. So you got to give him that.
Yeah.
Then the summer 91 comes and he starts feuding the Undertaker. and the whole stuff with Jake going on, where Jake's training him and then turns on him.
The Papa
and combo, then Warrior. Which... Well, that comes afterwards, because Warrior holds him up at SummerSlam 91, and they had the big falling out there. And there never was a blow off to that whole deal. And then Warrior comes back at Mania in 92 to help Hogan out. And he looks like he's in good shape there. He looked like he wasn't on the gas as much, or changed his gas. And then they did the whole Papa Shango feud, which we talked about Between the Sheets a few weeks ago, being one of the most ridiculous eras of wrestling, in my opinion. I hated that feud so much. It was just so fucking hokey and ridiculous. The ooze coming out of Warrior, the ooze coming out of Mean Gene, the vomiting. Just so cartoony and hokey and bullshit.
I'm bummed out y'all didn't pick Papa Shango for this. Actually, I guess he was, Charles Wright was nominated. We'll save him for the other era. We'll do Charles Wright in the Godfather.
And then, you know, they redo Savage again and for SummerSlam 92. And Bayface versus Bayface, which was odd because them working against each other meant Ric Flair didn't have a match on SummerSlam 92, which is still a travesty this day. And then he gets popped again, is gone for 4 years, makes the comeback at Mania, squashing Triple H at 96.
By far the highlight of his career. Yeah.
And then it was building probably for him to get another, at least a shot or a run at the world title, before he flakes out again and leaves. It would be interesting to see, because it kind of felt like that Shawn was going to get turned, and Shawn would have been the heel against Warrior, which would have been extremely interesting to watch how that would have played out.
I think Shawn could have pulled it off, because he was
he probably would have.
He was a great heel in that era, man, just a year later in 97.
He probably would have, for sure. It would just been very interesting to see. And of course, Warrior never comes back till, you know, later on. But I think that his significance and him being part of two of the most legendary matches in the history of the promotion warrants him a spot on this list somewhere. Now, I mean, he's definitely not a top half guy. Maybe he's not even really a top 75 guy. But I think he needs to be on this list somewhere.
Okay.
So that's why.
Okay. And Steve, I want to get your take on Warrior, but I don't want to know what you think about his like promos. Because me and my good buddy Charles, who I used to do a podcast with here and I help run Pro Wrestling Only with, he hates the Warrior promos. He hates the nonsensical garbage coming out of Warrior's mouth. And I find it hilarious. I'm like, Warriors! You know, I love it, you know? I mean, I'm such a mark for his stupid promos that, like, I'm transfixed, you know. But I know people who absolutely hate it. So I want to kind of get your take on Warrior, but I especially want to know what you think of his promos and his character work.
I have a buddy who, to this day, every time he calls me, the first words out of his mouth are Hulk Hogan. And then some variant of rocket ships and cocaine. I don't know. But Warrior is, full disclaimer, he was my first favorite. The first match I remember seeing was the night after Survivor Series 90, when DiBiase wrestled Warrior on the main event. As a kid, I was 8 years old. Here's this big, jacked up guy with face painted and tassels. He looked like something out of a damn comic book. So, at that age, I was going to be drawn to him. Character-wise, I mean, it was all just bullshit and gibberish, and there's no sense in any of it. But for the time, you know, it worked. It robbed him of the ability to connect like Hulk Hogan did with kids, because once you actually started listening to what he was saying, there was absolutely nothing there. I like the Savage feud better than I do the Rude feud, and a lot of that is, you know, I started watching right as that was starting up. And Savage was just on fire on his way out. The stuff with Cherry dropping to her knees to try to get Savage to give, or to give Warrior to give Savage a title shot. He blasted him with that damn scepter. Just really good work. From there was a deal with Warrior where it was a dark day in my neighborhood the day that Ultimate Warrior was locked in the airtight casket as Vince McMahon is crapping his pants the whole time. I mean, we were sure that Ultimate Warrior was going to die on Superstars that day. As far as the new generation stuff goes, you know, once he came back in 96, I never really thought that he fit. He seemed like just time had passed him by that point, especially with Shawn Michaels as the new guy they were building around. I just didn't see where he was going to fit. He probably will make my list just based off of the kind of one of my sentimental picks, maybe just above Ahmed Johnson.
No, you got to put Ahmed first.
You know, I wasn't going to include Ahmed, but then I remember that he was Suge Knight in the VH1 MC Hammer movie. And so he's going to be an honorary 100 now.
There you go. That's as good a reason as any. I'll tell you what, man. I've talked about this on previous podcasts before. I have no emotional attachment to that Warrior Savage feud, to that storyline with Liz and Sherry. I thought Sherry was the best worker out of all of them. That's why Sherry's going to be on my list and quite easily. But having said that, I can see, man, people like it, you know, and if it worked for everybody else, then it works. I'm not going to, you know, beat that dead horse. But I will say, I'm a little bit older than you guys. And I remember when I watched him as Dingo Warrior in Texas. You know, I was living in Texas and I saw him as the Dingo Warrior. So when he first came out, you know, with the music and shaking the ropes and everything, he was still the Dingo Warrior to me. You know, it's like, oh, okay. Oh, they're not calling him Dingo Warrior anymore, you know. But, man, even though he's never been one of my favorite guys, it was exciting, man, for him to come out, man, that energy. You know, I didn't know anything about him being like a careless worker or any of that crap, you know. And he was exciting. But I'm kind of conflicted because his run coincides with me falling out of love for wrestling. I didn't watch wrestling for a good seven or eight years, you know. And part of it was because of the colorful cartoon characters and all these guys I'd seen in the NWA or AWA or whatever territory, Mid-South, coming in as these hokey characters. It just bothered me at that time in my life, and I had no appreciation for anything from that era until much later. So, you know, I don't really have an emotional attachment to Warrior, except as the Dingo Warrior, and I love his promos. So I think he's going to make my list. I think I might just throw him on, like I said, at number 100, just to acknowledge, you know, that if nothing else, you could always say that Warrior is one of the most unique characters out there, right? Like, oh, yeah. You know, you can't really imitate Warrior. You know, I mean, you can have other big muscle-headed dudes, but not that act like that and have those kind of promos and that kind of manic energy. You know, just I haven't seen it. I don't think it can be reproduced. I know they tried in WCW with the Renegade, but that was a colossal failure.
I mean, people of a certain age group really look fondly on that Warrior-Hogan match, myself included. I mean, there are great matches I haven't watched in years, but I watch Warrior versus Hogan every year, Mania Week. That being said, I do. Yeah, it's a kind of embarrassing Steve fact there, but yeah, that happens in my house every March. That being said, didn't that match have kind of a low side on the buy rate compared to other Mania matches around that time?
It did, didn't it?
Yeah, but that was also part of another thing too. I think we covered on Between the Sheets. I think there was something with the cable companies at the time going on too, where it wasn't on some of the cable companies that it used to be on.
Kind of like one of those Vince versus the cable company feuds.
Yes, yes, that was one of those deals where I think that he had a setup where if they didn't take a package, they couldn't get Mania, and the ones that didn't take the package didn't get Mania. So there was a deal there involving that. But and Warrior's one of these guys, though. You look at like a lot of the wrestlers that came along in the 2000s. He's one of their biggest heroes. So his influence is deep among today's crop of wrestlers when they were kids.
Yeah, that's a fair point. You know,
LeBron James. in other sports, LeBron James, you know, famously wore an Ultimate Warrior shirt at last year after winning the championship.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Warrior was Warrior, but you definitely can't deny his influence, for sure.
No, I think I agree with that. Well, that's everybody that we have for this episode. Another 12 guys down. I kind of, like, when I watch the matches from this era, this new generation era, for me, a lot of it is new because, like I said, the Attitude Era on, I was watching everything. As a kid in the 80s, I was gobbling up as much wrestling as I could until I stopped watching. So this era, no matter how many projects I work on, yearbooks, WrestleMania projects, whatever, this era always kind of gives me something that either I've never seen before or I've never paid attention to before. And I'm kind of interested to see how many people from this era actually make my final list, because it's the one era where, like, I have zero emotional connection to, you know, and that's on me. That's not on anyone else. So haven't settled.
And it's also like the era that's known as the Dark Ages of wrestling. Yep. Too. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see how those guys shake out.
Right. This is the era of wrestling's low point, right? They're valley by far. Yeah. And so, you know, but they're
everybody, not just WWF, everybody.
But I'm glad we got to talk about guys like Earthquake and Yokozuna, because for the longest time, you know, in these internet communities, man, you know, these are guys that have been shit on. But then when you go back and watch the footage, you're like, oh, wow, man, these guys could go. You know, these guys had some good stuff, you know. And even someone like Jerry Lawler, who was kind of like a cartoon character in the Fed, but still had amazing matches and still one of the best wrestlers ever. So, you know, I don't know, man. I'm kind of interested because at least – like, you know, when we look at other eras, like Attitude Era is my least favorite era. Even though I watched everything, it's my least favorite era. But like this era is still kind of like the great unknown for me. So I'm kind of looking forward to diving into this era some more and seeing if these guys can either raise their stock on my list or if they drop lower than where I initially placed them. So, Chris, before we go, I don't know when this show is going to actually air on Place to Be. So just tell us what you have coming up and what you have recently released.
Well, you know, Between the Sheets every Monday. So go check those out when they come out. It's on Bass Street whenever that happens. You know, they're sparingly done, but they're out there. So all the shows are archived on Place to Be Nation or SoundCloud.com/BTSPod, so you can find them there.
And then you and our boy Devin Hells just did the reaction show.
Yeah, we do reaction shows just about every show. Sometimes we have to miss them due to other reasons, but we try to do them every time. So we got that. And Between the Sheets Patreon, if you want to check that out for exclusive content, patreon.com/Between the Sheets. And yeah, so that's all I got there.
Okay.
Because, again, we don't know when this is going to be dropping in particular, so I can't come out and say what show is going on, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So.
Right. Well, I mean, dude, you're a podcast legend, man. All those shows you did with me for all those years, and now you and Bix running with Between the Sheets, and, of course, my favorite, your Exile series, man, by far my favorite thing you've ever done. So, with all that said, Steve, your second podcast is in the books, man. How do you feel, man? You feel like a veteran yet?
Man, you know, I'm still getting my feet under me a little bit, but I do appreciate the opportunity to come learn under the two podcast gods here. Just earlier today, I was listening to Between the Sheets 100. Now here I am, not really half an hour later, talking to you guys.
Did you listen to all 8 hours of Between the Sheets
100? Right, yeah. Right now, I'm in the middle of the independent section with Prazak talking about death matches at truck stops and whatnot.
Hey,
yes,
Chris.
Yes.
Chris, I know you claim clean living, dude, but I'm calling it right now. Cocaine habit done.
No.
Yeah.
No.
You and Bix fucking popping those that cocaine up your nose.
I know he's on. He may be on some type of prescription meds, but I'm not. So I'm not on anything.
I'm joking.
I'm clean as a sheet. But no, I'm just crazy as hell, I guess.
Dude, I do 2 hours with y'all, and I'm like, I'm done, man. You do these 8-hour marathons.
Well, hey, again, I'm pulled the curtain back. We're not doing them all in one time.
No, don't pull the curtain back, man. I want to think of you as, like, you know, having this bender with, like, a bunch of coke and meth just there, man, keeping you pumped.
We used to. God knows we used to do that type of stuff, but. No, we smartened up in our old age and figured out a way to do it better. But yeah, Between the Sheets 100 is that show I'm very proud of. So definitely, if you want to check one out, that's a good one to check out. A lot of great shit on that show.
Awesome. All right. Well, I don't know what era or what topic we're going to talk about next for this series of shows, but I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to thank you two for hanging out with me, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.